Last month in the New York Times, there was an article titled, "The Troubling Trend in Teenage Sex." Before I even clicked on it, I knew what that troubling trend was, since I'd recently attended a medical conference where I heard a lecture from Dr. Debbie Herbenik about the increasing numbers of young adults that were including choking as part of their sexual repertoire. Today, I'm having a conversation with Dr. Herbenik about how common this practice has become and other current trends in sexual practices across America. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Dr. Debbie Herbenik is one of the foremost researchers on American sexual behavior and the author of many books, including Read My Lips, Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Right to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction, and her most recent book, Yes, Your Kid, What Parents Need to Know About Today's Teens and Sex. Dr. Herbenik first came on my radar when I was doing research for my book, Sex RX, Hormones, Health, and Your Best Sex Ever. Every time I went to one of my scientific search engines to find an article on whatever I was writing about, more often than not, she was the author of that article. Not surprising, given that Dr. Herbenik has written close to 200 scholarly articles on human sexual behavior across America in all age groups. From vibrator use to pornography, it was clear to me that Dr. Herbenik was the expert when it comes to what people are really doing in the privacy of their bedrooms. So when I bumped into her at a medical conference some years back, I practically asked for her autograph. I was so excited to meet her in the flesh. Since then, I've heard her speak many times and have gotten to know her, and I'm beyond excited to have this conversation. In preparation for this episode, I was scrolling through lists of her recently published articles, and I came across titles like, If Their Face Turns Purple, You're Probably Doing Something Wrong, Meanings of Rough Sex Across Gender, Sexual Identity, and Political Ideology, Porn Sex Versus Real Sex, Sexual Behaviors Reported by a U.S. Probability Survey Compared to Depictions of Sex in Mainstream Male-Female Pornography. On and on and on. And all I kept thinking is, there's too much. I have too many questions. So without further ado, I'm going to bring on Dr. Herbenik so I can start asking those questions. So welcome.
Thank you for having me here today.
Oh my gosh, I honestly don't know where to begin. There's so many things I want to ask you. But before we get to this terrifying trend of choking during sex, you've been researching sexuality and sexual practices for what, decades now?
About 25 years.
Yeah, 25 years. Okay, you've been at it a while. So you have perspective, you have a historical reference. I'd like to hear your thoughts on what kinds of sex do women really want? What does sexual pleasure look like for most people? And how's it changed, or has it changed over the last few decades?
I mean, it's certainly changed. I think we're in an era right now that's really strikingly different than we've ever seen it historically, as far as we can tell. But, you know, I think ultimately what people enjoy, and I'm going to say that differently than want, because I think they're two different things sometimes. I think when we look at what people really find pleasurable and enjoyable, we often come back to findings around feeling connected to a partner, feeling like they are seen. If we're talking about certain kinds of sexual behaviors, they can be things like vaginal intercourse, receiving oral sex, sex toy play. Some said there's kind of conflicting results on the kissing and cuddling. It probably depends on who your partner is and whether you feel like, you know, there's somebody you really want to kiss and cuddle and be that kind of affectionate with. But when I say I think it's different than wanting, I think what we're seeing right now that's really striking, and it's related to what you were talking about with the rough sex and choking, is that there's a narrative out there. It's a very strong and pervasive narrative across many media that desirable kinds of sex are very rough, and kinds of sex like the choking or strangulation that are higher risk. And so many people are asking for these kinds of sex. I mean, many women are, especially women 45 and under.
There's a difference between the kind of sexual activity that someone desires versus the kind of sexual activity that someone expects to occur, right?
It is, but there's a crossover here, right? Yeah. So there are some, I think, So one of the things that I've really been struck by some of our newest data, I don't think I shared at the conference because we had just gotten it in and we were still going through it. But we are now starting to see more young women choke themselves during masturbation too.
Whoa.
So
Okay, let's back up a little bit, because if we're,
don't bring
because we,
that up,
okay,
Rebecca.
okay, yeah, put a hold on that thought for a moment. Oh, okay, I have, yeah. All right,
I
anyway, so,
know. I
all right, but before we get to that, because I want to really focus on this choking thing, but before we get to that, you mentioned that this really has changed over the last few decades. When did you start to see the shift in what people desire and want during sex?
There's always shifts, right? So for example, earlier in the, late 90s or 2000s, there were shifts related to anal sex. A few years later, there were shifts related to sex toys and vibrators, right? So there's always different shifts that we see. They are usually not huge. They are usually smaller ebbs and flows that we see. And then the rough sex stuff we saw more around 2015. But there's always different kinds of shifts that we see in terms of, how people meet partners, the kinds of sex they have. Sometimes certain behaviors, like when Twilight was big, there was more biting. I mean, there's always something.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about this choking trend. And just so that everyone is clear about what we are talking about, specifically, when people are choking during sex, just walk us through what's happening.
So it's not always what people think. Engaging in choking, they are referring to using one hand, sometimes two, but it's usually one. Sometimes it's in like an arm wrapped around the neck, like a choke hold. Less often it's a leg, very less often it's a ligature, like a belt, a cord, or a tie. And it's either pressing against the neck, like with a hand pressing or squeezing against the neck, or wrapped around the neck in the case of an object and then squeezing the neck. And people do this at all different intensities on a scale of 1 to 10. They will report anything from really light to really intense. But that's the general gist of what they're referring to. And they don't always know what's happening in the body. In fact, they often don't know what's happening in the body, but some do. And so some are intentionally trying to restrict blood flow, and some are intentionally trying to restrict airflow. Some think they're doing both, and around a third we find just really don't know what they're doing when they're pressing or squeezing that.
So, is there a specific timing to choking? Is this during the initiation of sexual activity? Does it help people become aroused? Does it help people orgasm? Is that even known?
So when we started a really focused study on this about 4 or 5 years ago, we found that more often people were choking around the time of intercourse. So it was something that they would co-occur with intercourse to enhance arousal or in less often facilitate orgasm. These days, what we're seeing is it is more often occurring even with just kissing and making out. And so that means that people are starting younger when they start kissing and making out. And it also means that during a sexual encounter, there may be more episodes of choking within a sexual encounter because they might choke during the kissing and making out. They might continue choking during intercourse and so
Yeah.
on.
How common is this?
Extremely common for college students, let's say. Consistently across 4 studies and different time periods, we found that about two-thirds of women report having ever been choked during sex. And that is a shockingly high number for those of us in the field. This was a behavior that, 20 years ago, if we had put a number to it, probably most of us would have said 1% or fewer were engaging in choking or strangulation. And so that is about two-thirds of college women, around a little bit less than a third of men report having been choked. And a bit more than half of trans and non-binary college students report having been
I'm
choked during
curious
sex.
with the men who've been choked, is that women choking them or more in same-sex relationship?
It's more often by other men, but when they do it with women, it's more often exploring. Like, well, if you're going to choke me, I want you to see what it feels like. It is almost always men choking women.
In the New York Times article, Lisa Orenstein, who wrote the article, and she's also the author of Girls and Sex, and she said, quote, I was initially startled in early 2020 when, during a post-talk Q&A at an independent high school, a 16-year-old girl asked, "How come boys all want to choke you?" In a different class, a 15-year-old boy wanted to know, Why do girls all want to be choked? They do. Not long after, a college sophomore contacted me after her roommate came home in tears because a hookup partner, without warning, had put both hands on her throat and squeezed. So there's two things that jump out. Number one is the age that you're seeing this in. You know, 15, 16-year-olds are experiencing this. And the other is the lack of consent. You know, that this is not necessarily consensual. It's just something that's happening. So first of all, let's talk about the age. You are seeing this in young people, right?
We are. Yeah, most of our research has been with adults, but some of it has involved teenagers. And of those who have some type of partnered experience with the teenagers, it can be as many as like in the 10 to 20% of range of teenagers who teenage girls who have been choked. And it seems to be increasing. So when we look at our college students, for example, 4 years ago, we found that 1 in 4 of them reported having choked or been choked during adolescence between ages 12 and 17. And now it's closer to 40% of those college students started at young ages.
Do the majority of these women, A, consent, B, encourage it, and C, want it, or do they just find themselves in these situations that they can't control?
It's all of that. It's all of it. So when we ask them if it's consensual, overwhelmingly, they tell us it is. I mean, people of all genders overwhelmingly tell us their experiences are largely consensual. We have an average of about 92% of instances described as consensual. Although some of them are talking about it in advance, many aren't. So they describe that they make a decision to choke based on what they call the vibe, or the energy in the room. And that's not specific to choking. We've seen that in consent research before with oral sex, vaginal sex. One path to choking that concerns me especially is that some young men will describe putting their hand on their partner's neck and kind of lightly just sort of resting it there and then looking at them to gauge. And if their partner seems okay, doesn't resist, doesn't say no, doesn't, you know, turn away or push their hand away, then they proceed with choking. And women confirm that approach as well. So that's concerning because if the hand is already on the neck, their partner may not really feel like they can say no. I mean, that's a very vulnerable position to be in. And then many people just say that they don't talk about it because it's just such a normative part of sex. It's just what you do. And so it's very commonly accepted. And we hear that in both directions, right? We hear, no, I mean, no, he didn't ask, but I wouldn't expect him to. I mean, it's just what you do.
And right. So, any more than I'm not going to ask permission or get permission for him to put his hand on my breast or,
right.
to, you know, to. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's all part of the same. How much, I don't know if this is even answerable, but how many women really have pleasure from this? I mean, there's a difference between engaging in sexual activity because it's expected or you think it's the current norm, or you want to maintain the relationship, or all of the other things that make people do things sexually that they don't necessarily want to do. But do you think that there are people that have true sexual arousal, enhancement of orgasm, and pleasure from this?
I mean, yes, I do, right? I mean, we've known that throughout history, there's well-documented cases for hundreds of years. It's just that it was rare, right? So it's a very small of the population that seems to enjoy breath play types of activities and specifically choking strangulation, which is a higher risk form of it. You know, I think of the 20 something women that we interviewed, there were two that stuck out to me that I've said to colleagues, I think if you took these women at any historical time or place, they probably would have found their way to this practice. They really, really, really liked it. You know, the other 20 something of them would not have. I think they're a product of their culture. In our big nationally representative surveys, when we ask people about their most recent sexual event and we look at all the different kinds of things they did and we look to see what predicts pleasure and what predicts orgasm, we still find things like intercourse and oral sex and sex toy use, but not choking. Choking does not predict pleasure or orgasm.
When you asked about choking and pleasure, was this part of a multiple choice list that they could just check it off? Or when you said, what gives you pleasure, was it an open-ended question?
We ask people in these nationally representative surveys, thinking about your most recent sexual event. And then we have a whole series of questions, right? Who was your partner? How recently was it? You know, all these sorts of things.
And in that study, they did see a long list of behaviors: kissing, cuddling, giving oral sex, receiving oral sex, and so on. And they also included choking a partner or being choked by a partner. And we've done this in previous studies before choking became a thing, where we would look at all of these different behaviors. And then on other items, we would look to see how pleasurable they rated that encounter, and then whether they had more than one orgasms or no orgasms. So we really kind of statistically modeled it to say, you know, based on what we see here, what their like different characteristics of the encounter, their behaviors and other aspects, does it predict pleasure? Does it predict orgasm? So it's not saying, was it pleasurable? When we ask that, quite a lot of people say it's pleasurable. It's more saying, here's all the things that are happening. What statistically predicts pleasure and what statistically predicts orgasm? And in those cases, we found that even though in other studies, people say the choking is pleasurable, we're not actually finding that it seems to really be the pleasure driver, if you will. It still seems to be the other kinds of behaviors, which makes sense because there's no reason for most people that being choked or strangled would facilitate orgasm. They might like it because it feels kinky or adventurous, is what they tell us.
It's the adventure aspect of it as opposed to a physical sensation that occurs as a result of this. All right, so this is rampant on college campuses, evidently. Is this rampant in bedrooms across America and people who are a little bit older, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s?
Well, you know, so kind of 45-ish and under is where we see it to be more common. It's going to be most common, you know, around sort of like 35 and under, but we see it as almost a non-existent thing for people 45 and older, unless they're kind of out there dating and hooking up. We do hear from people who are rejoining dating and they're on Tinder and Grindr in their 40s, 50s, and above. And consensually or not, some of them are encountering a sense that, wow, sex is really different than the last time I was, you
You
know.
think? Even in a world where it is consensual, both people are asking for this and want this, and that there is pleasure, let's talk about medical consequences, because that's actually how you ended up speaking at this medical conference, was to ring the alarm bells for physicians in sexual medicine to know that not only are people doing this, but your research has really pointed out that this is not a benign practice when it comes to consequences and medical repercussions. So talk about that a little bit.
Certainly, you know, as a physician, that this is serious stuff, that it's nothing to take lightly. You know, you mentioned how prolific I am in terms of writing, right? But I mean, that it's really a lot of it is driven by a sense of urgency because this is such a stark trend to see. It's really consequential in terms of health. And I'm in public health, so I think about prevention of harm and injury a lot. What I saw with my own college students and the young people in our studies is that most of them had no idea.
There's actually a vast medical literature on the health effects of strangulation, but most of that research
Oh,
isn't
wait, back
around.
up, because you said strangulation. Is strangulation and choking the same thing, or are they different things?
They're the same thing.
They're the same thing.
So
But that's an important point.
So external pressure to the neck that is decreasing, you know, blood flow, airflow, is technically strangulation, even though everyone these days calls this sexual practice choking. Technically, what choking is when you choke on food or toys and it blocks the internal airways.
Right.
So the terminology is a little tricky, but it is strangulation. And so when we acknowledge that this is strangulation, then we have the benefit of this huge medical literature that tells us that being strangled is associated with short-term health consequences and also long-term health consequences. Some of these can be really immediate and dangerous, like dying. It's very rare in consensual choking, but it can happen and it does happen. Some of them can be things like cardiac arrest or stroke. The interesting thing was when we got into this research initially, people were really under the impression that the way that they were doing it was safe. They would often say the way other people do it isn't safe, but the way I do it is safe. But they hadn't so much as Googled it. They hadn't checked with a nurse or doctor. They just had sort of watched porn or talked with friends or gotten tips from a partner and were going about it. We heard this over and over again, the way that they did it was safe. Even within kink and BDSM communities, they would say, yeah, but this isn't like other forms of strangulation. And we heard that so much. And so I said, well, let's just find out, right? Like What are people noticing in their bodies? And we ask people what they are experiencing in terms of things like bruising. We've had around 15, 16% report having neck bruising. We've had about 4% report neck swelling, which is really concerning because in the other strangulation research, you see that, you can have a potential airway collapse up to 36 hours later. So it can be life-threatening if you see swelling. None of the articles that are online about choking talk about being on alert for neck swelling, for example. And there's all these other kind of hidden things like carotid artery dissection and so on that can elevate risks for stroke at, some later point even. And
Well,
so
especially I would imagine if it's repetitive. It's one thing to do it once, but if someone is doing this as part of their regular sexual repertoire.
exactly. And so not only are many people doing it as part of their repertoire, so we found that lately our recent college data show that 1 in 5 college students have been choked 25 times or more. So that's a lot. And so it's a really regular part of their sexual repertoire, especially when they're being choked or strangled, or often choked multiple times at an encounter, like we talked about from the kissing at different stages during intercourse. So it is such a stress on the body. And we have shown, and our colleague who you saw at the conference as well, Dr. Kay Kawada, has also done research involving brain scans and taking blood draws to look at blood biomarkers that kind of give some sense into how the brain is responding to this, and finding really robust differences between groups of women who have either never been choked or strangled during sex and those who have been choked, at least in his study, 4 more times in the past month. This is still early stage for our work, and we need to find out a lot more. But at this point, it's certainly clear that there are effects on the body, should
Long-term
be
consequences.
talking about this. Yeah.
Okay, every single parent who has a kid in college is listening to this and freaking out, right? So I have good news. Your most recent book, Yes, Your Kid, addresses this. And every parent, of course, should read this book. I'll put the link in the program notes. But you talk about in this book what parents need to know about sexual practices and how to talk about it with their kids. Chapter one is, I love that question, becoming an askable parent. How does one become a parent that even has this conversation with their kids? And how do they do it without sounding like they're being sex negative or judgmental? Because that's the one thing is you don't want anyone listening to this saying, well, gee, I thought you guys were sex positive. We're very sex positive. This isn't about being sex positive. This is about safety.
It is about safety. And I do think parents can step into these conversations with teenagers and with young adults, college students, and so on. And that we should. The sort of bad news, good news part of the situation is right now, choking is such a part of mainstream culture. The upside to it is that there's a lot of teachable moments for parents. For example, as mentioned in the New York Times article by Peggy Orenstein, Jack Harlow, Lovin' on Me, spent 6 weeks at number one this winter. And it begins by saying, I'm Vanilla Baby, I'll choke you, but I ain't no killer baby, right? So not only describes choking, but describes it as vanilla. And that song is repeated throughout, or that line is repeated throughout the song. It is like the hook used on the TikTok videos, and about 2 million TikTok videos created largely by teenagers and young adults. So if your kid listens to that,
All
talk
right,
about
call
it.
me out of it. I've never even heard of that song or that artist. What did you say his name was again?
His name is Jack Harlow. The YouTube video for that song has now been viewed more than 100 million times, and the song's only been out a few months. And
Boggles the
so,
mind. Boggles
yeah.
the mind.
So lots of parents, when I talk with them, they know their kid likes Jack Harlow. He's one of the biggest, most popular performers these days. So if they like Jack Harlow, enter through that song. If they, watch Euphoria or The Idol, the very first episode of those shows show a young woman being choked by a guy. There are social media
But how
memes.
but was it, did they start the conversation with,
Yeah.
hey, I know this is out there and I've heard it in the song and I've saw it on the TV show. And I'm just wondering, is this something that you do? I mean, is that how you would bring it up?
Before going to what you do, I would ask something like, are you hurt? Have you heard of this? Is this something you and your friends talk about? So even as an adolescent researcher, we often get a lot more information from teens if we start by asking about, kids your age, people your age, like your friends, and then you can maybe if the conversation is going well, ask about them.
Yeah.
But very often, just asking about their friends or things they hear at school or people your age, they will acknowledge it.
Yeah,
In
this is a
fact,
great idea just in general. I mean, obviously not just about choking, anything you want to ask your kid.
anything, drugs, alcohol, things they've heard, by asking them about their friends, asking them about their friend group, if they acknowledge some awareness of it, what it gives us is an opportunity to say, yeah, I didn't know that this was such a big thing, and I want to share some information with you. So you can have a little bit of information, but also ask what they think about it. There's a few different key points here. Some of it is the consent and the communication that we talked about earlier. They should know that you never, ever should just be springing this on somebody, and it can harm people. We don't want our kids to wind up assaulting other people or facing sexual assault charges, which I see a lot of these instances these days on campuses and with teenagers that are really sad. And so they need to know about the communication consent piece.
Do we know how many people have died?
We don't have any systematic reporting of that. We know that there are deaths, there are media reports, but there is no central place where
Yeah.
that is tracked, which is really concerning. If we see a media report, we try to look for media reports where somebody is facing charges for their partner unintentionally dying during choking experience or other kinds of rough sex. But unfortunately, there's not systematic tracking, which we need, I think, in order to really,
Well, and it would be kind of compelling when you're having this conversation with your kid to say, and by the way, X number of people die from this or have long-term brain injury. That would be a real conversation starter. Christina Suppler and Susan Stone are attorneys, and they are contributors of this book. I happen to know them because I was a guest on their podcast, Real Talk. And every parent and college student, after they read your book, needs to listen to that podcast. I'm kind of assuming this is the first book you've written that includes a legal perspective, right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about that. How did that come about? How important is it? And what was their contribution?
Yeah, so they first reached out, some years ago now because they had come across my research in relation to some of their cases. And they were seeing a lot of the things that I was seeing among my college students and in my research. And so we were really, we would often talk about just how surprising these trends in rough sex and choking were. Of course, they are attorneys and they work with teenagers, with young adults, with people of all ages. And a good part of what they do is dealing with sexual misconduct and sexual assault cases. So they have such important and insightful stories that come from the real world, right? And I felt that they were so important to include in the book because they do give parents exactly what you were talking about, or some examples to say, wait, in the real world, right? Like this really happened and somebody did this thing and it harmed this person in this way. They face these kinds of consequences because many young people don't, and many parents think, and this relates to the title of her book, oh, not my kid or not me. But these things really do happen, especially in a world in which these sexual behaviors have changed so quickly without any supports around sex education or consent or
Yeah.
communication. So they have very, very, I think compelling stories that are shared throughout the book relating to consent, to choking and rough sex, to contraceptive issues, and they are living these experiences with families
Yeah. Well, I can vouch for that
part of their
because
work.
the way that I met them is they actually hired me as an expert to help out with one of these cases because there was an issue of there not only being non-consent and assault, but a gynecologic consequence of this that they brought me in to talk about if that consequence was a result of sex without consent. So I was pulled into their world, which is fascinating, and learned so much myself about consent, about what's going on in college campuses. And that's how I even knew that the book was coming out even before it came out. So it's really a very, very, not only just an interesting read, but it's really important, really important. I think this is just something that, like you said, it's out there, it's in the mainstream, and it is dangerous. So people need to know about it. All right, I could go on about this stuff for hours, but I do want to get to a few other topics. You recently published a paper titled Sexual Repertoire, Duration of Partnered Sex, Sexual Pleasure and Orgasm, findings from a U.S. nationally representative survey of adults. And you surveyed over 2,500 adults, correct? And these were both, you know, about half men, half women about their sexual practices. So there's a lot to unpack in that article. But the first thing I'm wondering is, based on your research, is the orgasm gap finally starting to narrow in America? Are women starting to have orgasms even close to the number of times men are having orgasms during partner sexual activity?
No, not at all.
I was hoping you would say something different.
No, you know, I think we're seeing some changes in orgasm, but I don't think they're really narrowing the gap in a meaningful way at this point. And it's too bad, right? And I know we're changing the topic here, but I do think that rough sex and choking is part of that.
Because it's non-consensual. Non-consensual things, not always non-consensual, but often non-consensual. And terrifying non-consensual sexual activity is generally not great for orgasm, right?
Yeah, so for those who it's non-consensual for, certainly, but even for the consensual part, I think what I've found so interesting in the interviews too is that I think, right, when some people are focusing on choking, they're not really focusing on orgasmic kinds of things, because choking is not orgasmic for the vast majority of people. Yes. So they're not, you know, I always remember this one interview I did with a young man who really, said, hey, this doesn't do much for me, but my partner seemed to really like it, so I do it in terms of choking them. And I asked him why, and he thought it would enhance their arousal maybe. And I asked him if he had ever, you know, used a vibrator on a partner. He sort of looked at me like I was crazy. And he said, you know, why would I do that?
Why would
I use vibrators? And I said, because it might, you know, like actually yeah. like enhance her orgasm and pleasure, but there's no risk of death, you know, like and so I think it's interesting. Like there was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, there was such an interest among college students in vibrator use and like clitoral stimulation and all of the stuff around the genitals. And I'm not seeing that as much anymore. Right. So I also think that, and that's more what I was meaning, is that I think there's this focus on roughness rather than intimacy, connection, pleasure, the clitoris, all of that.
Yeah. You know, it just occurred to me this week, I was giving a lecture to graduate students at Northwestern. I'm on the faculty of the medical school, but also in the graduate school. And it was about reproductive physiology and sexual health. And I was talking to them about what occurs during arousal. You know, the heart rate going up, you start to breathe a little more quickly, that your appetite decreases. So I go through this whole list of things that occur during arousal and say, what other circumstance do we see those changes in? And the answer, of course, is fear. You know, when the lion enters the room is when you start to breathe faster, your heart rate goes up. There's all these changes that occur in the body. But I always then put the question out, but what's the difference between fear and arousal in terms of a physiologic reaction, a physiologic response? And the answer is genital engorgement. You know, when the lion enters the room, most women do not lubricate and have increased blood flow to the genitals. That's the difference. So my question to you is, for people that do enjoy choking, which to me is basically a fear situation, are they getting increased blood flow to the genitals? Do we know that? Is there a true arousal response going on?
We don't know.
We don't know. Because that to me would be the interesting research question. Because when we talk about people that do enjoy it sexually, that do become aroused, one would assume that they are getting that increased blood flow. So another one of many, many questions to explore going through.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So coming back to this other study, orgasm gap aside, which is sad, what did you learn about duration of partnered sex in this study?
Yeah,
how long do people actually have sex? Is it like, you know, 2 minutes or more like 20 minutes?
Oh, I can't remember the exact figure.
I
think it was, yeah. And so it was like the whole sexual encounter wasn't just intercourse, which is important to know, because some studies kind of slice it and dice it. You know, it was more like, you know, I want to say somewhere around 15, 20 minutes, if I remember. But we had, you know, women generally being fine with the duration that they had, men often wanting longer durations of sex, and same-sex couples were having and often, you know, rating very highly these longer sexual sessions together.
I came across you years ago when I was doing research for my book, as I mentioned, and a lot of it was because you had the most scholarly articles out there, still do, about vibrator use in America. Who's using it, how often they're using it, how these trends have changed. So what can you tell us about your most recent research and vibrator use in America?
Vibrator and sex toy use has, and you know, continued to increase, not hugely, but has continued to increase from those earlier studies that were from, I think, 2008, when we conducted the big U.S. nationally representative survey on vibrator use. It's not just vibrators anymore. There are these really, you know, interesting air pressure toys out there, like the Womanizer. So I think that the products themselves have continued to innovate in interesting ways. And we're seeing a lot safer products than we did in the past. At the time of our earlier studies, a lot of the products out there were not very high quality. And we saw, I think it was around 21% of women, for example, who had experienced at least some side effects from vibrator use. They were mostly pretty mild. But, you know, some had experienced numbness and irritation and pain and so on. So we don't have newer data on the side effects from sex toy or vibrator use. Hopefully they would find that there's been some improvement, both with, you know, as we've had better products, but also as there's been a lot more education about how to use these products in the right. last 15, 20 years. When we did that earlier study, it was still so taboo and still many magazines weren't talking about sex toys and vibrator use, but they do now.
They do.
And so that's good.
It is good. In your original research, you talked about vibrator use in solo sexual activity versus partnered sexual activity, because prior to that research, I think the general feeling was that, oh, well, a vibrator is something you use when you don't have a partner, as opposed to something that you do with a partner. And your initial research, of course, turned that upside down. So what did you find out about that in your more recent research?
Yes. And so we're still continuing to see a lot of partnered use. I think one of the other assumptions that people sometimes make is that men don't use sex toys alone, but they do. Not nearly at the rates that women do, but they do. And they always have. And so I think that those stereotypes aren't completely gone for men. I think men are still subject to some incorrect ideas about their sexuality. That they only use hands to masturbate, for example, or they don't enjoy the variety that many men actually do.
You mentioned that using vibrators and other sexual accessories, I always call them tools, because mm-hmm. I think it's important to acknowledge that toys are to make something more pleasurable, whereas tools are, especially as we get into older women, are to make things possible. But there are a lot of different uses. But you mentioned that vibrator use was very common among young women, college age women, women in their 20s. And years ago, it was not as common among older women. And I'm wondering if you have looked at that and if you've seen a change in that trend, because certainly what I do in my world with sexual medicine, and we talk so much about how older women need to have vibration. It's not just something they like it to make it better. They need to have vibration in order to have an orgasm. And do you feel like that message is getting out, that it's not as taboo, that more women who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s and up are using vibrators?
Certainly more women in their 40s and 50s. We have data that go all the way through the mid 90s. I just honestly don't remember off the top of my head how high it is. So part of that's also generational, right? That many women in their 40s and 50s now did sort of come of age at a time when there was some acceptance. But for women in their 80s and 90s, not so much. And so for the fewer women, I mean, we do see some sex toy use there or sexual use, but it's certainly not as prevalent. But it is there. You know, I think we still need maybe continued focused education and support to help normalize that aspect of sexual enhancement and exploration.
Yeah. In the few minutes we have left, I want to talk about another research area of interest for you, and that's pornography. And one of your more recent articles address if real life sexual practices, what people are actually doing, mirrors what they are watching in porn films. What did you find?
Well, of course, we found that it doesn't mirror it.
I knew that was coming, but
It just doesn't, right? I mean, in pornography, especially pornography between men and women, there's almost no condom use. I mean, it's like 2 to 3% of scenes. Usually, in most studies, find that there's condoms being used. Pornography shows many more sexual behaviors that pleasure men than women. But in real life, fortunately, people are doing more things like cunnilingus and intercourse and sex toy use that women enjoy. We wanted to do that study just to have some data because people, certainly, sex educators often say that real life sex is different than porn sex in a unique position where we had some colleagues who had done this really expansive look at the pornography that was out there. And they had tracked very carefully in thousands of scenes the kinds of sex that were shown. And then our team had all of these great nationally representative data. So we could say, well, let's look at it. They were both from the same year, the same time period. And so, that as a sex educator, I also very selfishly wanted to have data like that so that I could use it to teach my own college students and in the community to say very clearly what the differences were in the real life sex and the sex as depicted in pornography.
Overall, as a sexual researcher and educator, what do you tell people about watching pornography in terms of it being sexually healthy, not healthy, enhancing relationships, not? Is there data?
There's lots of different studies and for different age groups and genders and situations. So it really varies. But there is, certainly some data that suggests that people sometimes make partner comparisons. So for people who are watching pornography, to be really on the lookout for that, if that's something that you find your mind doing and maybe feeling less satisfied with your partner because you're comparing them to pornography. And if you're somebody who does that, then you might want to not watch so much. I mean, some people do take, as they call it, porn vacations or hiatuses to see if it makes a change in their life. For young people, the messages are really different. I mean, first of all, they're reminding them that this is adult material made by adults for other adults. It's not the way that sex usually looks. And you can give them some examples of what that means in terms of condom use, communication, consent, and certainly like the roughness of it. Because, the average age at first seeing pornography now is 12 from a Common
No,
Sense Media
really?
report. And that's consistent with other research too. So it's an average age, right? So we know that we are seeing some 7, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds seeing pornography and also then some teens first seeing it then. And so the Common Sense Media report is a really, really important one, I think, for parents and educators and researchers to read. Not only does it give us like the average age data and the frequency data, but it gives us a sense of where they're accessing it. And of course, it's not just home, but it's also friends' houses and school buses and all of that. And we hear that in our studies too. And, encouraging young people, I mean, one of the messages I give is that for many young people, they will start at a younger age and watch it for years before they actually have a partnered sexual experience.
So that's
And
why
that
they
can
have so
actually kind
many
of be
unrealistic
great.
expectations of
Very
what's going
unrealistic.
to happen during that sexual experience. Do we know how often porn is watched to masturbate versus as a prelude or during partnered sex? Because I would imagine that it is more common during partnered sex than it used to be. Am I wrong?
Do have some data on partnered sex. It's not much at an event level. I think there are many more people who have watched porn during sex at least once or twice, but they don't seem to do it frequently enough. And so it doesn't really show up too much if we look at the event level or like the people's
Yeah,
last
so
sex.
that's not really a thing.
Yeah.
So you've established that we have kids and a lot of very young teens watching porn. What about on the other end? Are we seeing this as people age and very often are quite frankly unpartnered, as they get older?
It declines. Most sexual things decline, in the 60s and beyond. And although satisfaction tends to remain pretty high.
And do men and women tend to watch different kinds of porn?
Well, certainly different kinds and also different frequencies of it. I mean, men in every study I can think of in multiple countries watch pornography much more often. There are a lot of the data that are out there on like specific genres come from the companies themselves. They release reports, some of them. So it's a little bit hard to know how to trust some of those data. I mean, they're clearly used for marketing purposes, but they are generally going to be watching, different kinds of pornography.
As a sweeping generalization, when women watch pornography, do they tend to watch romantic sorts of encounters that end in sexual activity, or Are they looking more at, if for lack of a better word, calling it a fantasy encounter? You know, that maybe it's something they would never do themselves, or something that's a little rough, or something that's with a person who they would never even want to have. You know, what are women watching? What are, do we know?
Well, you know, one of the challenges is that porn has changed. And I was talking about this with a colleague the other day. Porn used to be a scene, like a whole scene and a story. And that was more what you saw. It was on DVD. And now, if you go to porn, you know, to very popular porn sites, especially the free online ones, they are snippets. And so there's not often really much of a scene. It's like looking for a behavior or a certain gender makeup or a certain number of people. But there's not a whole lot of the
So it's
scene
just sex. It's
anymore.
not, there's not a narrative. There's not a story.
Unless you're specifically going to like the sites that are often paid sites where you can get more of the scene and the story. But
So it's, I want to watch sex
porn that
between
people are
two
accessing, which is
blonde-haired
free,
people that
is
are
a
over
snippet.
6 feet tall. You know, you'll find
Yeah,
that.
something like that. Yeah. You
But
look
there's
for a
no
very
story.
specific genre.
Okay. It's a crazy world. You're at Indiana University. And I would imagine that you've been very vocal there about the dangers of choking. Do you think it's having an impact? Do you think that the students are saying, wait a minute, maybe this isn't such a good idea? I'm talking about just because of the medical risks.
Once you share them, that they actually, most of them will say, I didn't know this. This changes everything for me. And, you know, and there's other ways that I can explore, that I can be submissive or dominant or whatever they want to be, and that don't have these same risks. And so some of them will still do it, and they are looking for, they will tell us, don't give us an abstinence message, tell us how to do it more safely. And we're really kind of stuck
Where
behind
is
a
that?
rock in a hard place there because we can't tell them how to do it safely. They don't love hearing that, but it's the truth. Other people, though, really, really are very open to the information and often really surprised and sad and upset that no one told them about it sooner, which again is why I think whether it's as clinicians or parents, you know, college professors, we should be talking about it because they actually do want the information that they can make their own choice.
Is this memo making it to other college campuses other than Indiana
I
University?
have Yes, I have heard from so many campuses over the past few years since I started doing this work. Also, because many of them are seeing these same sexual assault reports come up in their campuses where people may have consented to sex or to a hookup, but not consented to the choking or the hitting or the smothering or something else. So really, so many college campuses. I mean, I hate to say probably all, but it's probably almost all. I've heard even from some very conservative schools who can't believe this is happening on their campus, but it is. And it's happening around the world. There's newer data out this year from Germany, from Iceland, from let's see where else. Germany, Iceland, Italy. You know, New Zealand, Australia. And so we know that it's not just a US thing. It's not just a college campus thing. We've got nationally representative data on it too. Sex has changed for young adults and for teenagers. And we need to be talking about it with each other, you know, sharing more of the same media in our families, not just because of the choking stuff, but so we can just understand what our kids' worlds are like and the kinds of decisions that they're having to grapple with and so on.
Yeah. And I think also this information is not just important for teens and young adults, but as you said, we have midlife people and older people who are out there, they are dating and they are coming across situations that they never would have dreamed at and certainly did not experience when they were in their 20s or 30s. Thank you so much for spending this time. I will be sure and put the links to all your books, all of this information in the program notes. And I look forward to continuing to see your name come across my medical feeds for new research that you are providing us with that is really making a difference.
Thank you. It's so good to see you again.
I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, and thank you for joining me. You will find lots more information in my Insight Information books available on Amazon.com. And follow Francie as she navigates her way through vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and pretty much every menopausal symptom you can think of.
Sometimes I feel blue. She helped me see. the light.